We've talked about the idea of controlling weather, but is there any evidence? See it for yourself in the September After Dark magazine. Charles Osman writes about engineering weather and even moving hurricanes, complete with photos that you can't find anywhere else. Also, are machines finally smarter than we are? Will they take over? And time travel? Is it possible? And who has tried it? And an interview with John Lash on Archons. It's a complicated world out there, and the After Dark magazine is there for Coast to Coast AM listeners every month. News, humor, relevant information, plus an editorial by yours truly every month. It's your insider info into Coast to Coast AM. Subscribe now. Call 1-888-727-5505. Lines are open. 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. $39.95 for 12 monthly issues or online, coasttocoastam.com.
You never know what you'll hear on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
I'm concerned about the divide that's happening in this country right now. It's almost as if you cannot talk publicly about how you feel about an issue without getting stampeded by someone who doesn't agree with you. And you know what? That's dangerous in this country. The luxury of the United States has been our ability to be able to talk and explain and to take positions without being attacked and ridiculed. And I've never seen it worse than it is today. And it's got to change because, you know, it's going to take us down the wrong path. I just want the truth. I want us to be able to go after an issue, whether it's the swine flu or health insurance. I just want the truth. And then from that point, we as Americans can make up our own minds.
Now we take you back to the night of September 22nd, 1997, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
All right, well, an expert on the pyramids. Once again, here is Boris Said. Boris, welcome back.
I don't know if I'm an expert on the pyramids, Art. I'm a documentarian who's had some extraordinary experiences there. I don't think anybody's an expert on the pyramids.
Well, that's a good point. And I guess we are just, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is conjecture regarding why they're there, how they got there, and what they're for.
Exactly. I think the one thing that's at the bottom of all of this is that we've got to look at it. I think that to simply dismiss something that awesome as a tomb and ignore the fact that there are pyramids in England and Japan and China and Tibet and
Mexico,
all through Central and South America, is doing somebody a disservice, ourselves a disservice by not investigating these things.
How can you imagine, since you mentioned that, Boris, that I can certainly imagine in Egypt, for some reason that we might not imagine, they came up with the concept of the pyramids and built them somehow. All right, but the rest of the world, I mean, the rest of the world then was not even connected. So how could pyramids appear across the rest of the face of the globe?
Well, it's a great question. If we're going to view the thing three-dimensionally, I mean, I heard you say that my good friend Michio Kaku is going to be on Wednesday night.
Yes, he is.
He's a great believer in the fact that you cannot understand the universe if you look at it as three dimensions. If you look at the drawings on the plains of Nazca and try and imagine how they could have been done by somebody on the ground. So many of the monuments all over our world had to have been conceived from a height. Otherwise, how do they manage to make them? How do they manage to do these huge drawings that span miles, acres?
I don't have a clue.
That's right. So to assume, first of all, I think it's wrong to assume that the first pyramids were in Egypt. Because we don't know where the first pyramids were. I mean, there's one in China that's now destroyed down to, I guess, to within 10 feet of the ground. It's supposed to be a mile on a side.
Whew. Which they date to when?
I don't know. I don't think they do. I don't think they can. I don't think there's enough of it. The problem is that you get experts in that field, and they pontificate, and they say, well, this is the date. And that's where their error is.
They're guessing.
That's right.
There really is no way, carbon dating and all the rest of that, there's no way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about it. I understand that there's a way now of establishing that there's some sort of cosmic radiation, and you can measure that if you get the right kind of samples. But again, that's over my head. What I'm advocating is that we look at these things, and we look at them and not hide them, and not pretend that they're not there, and above all, not keep this knowledge from people who are curious, who are interested, who'd like to have opinions on.
Well, I certainly agree with you regarding Professor Kaku, who will be here Wednesday, that it is arrogant for us to believe that we can understand all, looking at things in simply three dimensions, when there may be many, many more, which will bring insights and instant understanding when we can get to those dimensions. And one has to wonder if what we've been discussing about the frequency and the altered states produced inside the Great Pyramid might not be the gate to get one to that understanding.
Well, every civilization before ours has believed in something of that sort. The Zulus and the Aborigines and the Maoris and the Native Americans, the Hopis, all believed that there was a way of getting to the center of the earth, or in any event to get out of here, to get into another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So why suddenly are we not believing this?
All right. I've got a couple of tough questions for you. I guess we better start with, you became involved with the Shore Expedition how long ago?
Okay, and I became involved with the Shore Expedition in 1995.
95.
In the fall of 1995.
And what was the idea? What was the expedition going to do?
Well, let me start one step back, Mark. I had gone to Egypt in August, basically on a free ticket from TWA on some air miles because nothing was happening. I was trying to market a program, oddly enough, about Michio Kaku's work. And I went to call on Dr. Hawaz because I thought that we had used him rather badly in Mystery of the Sphinx. He had opposed everything John West wanted to do, and I thought he sort of came off as the bad guy in the film.
John West, actually, Anthony, is not allowed at Giza now, is he, or is he now allowed back?
Well, I don't know, and Art, I got to tell you that there is so much hurling of rocks and epithets and what one guy said and somebody else said. I don't know. John seems to have a knack for making people angry. I don't want any part of it. I had an expedition with John. It was, I thought, quite successful. It didn't end so well, but we certainly approved a point in spite of all the acrimony that there was between the Egyptian officials and John West. And I think that we established that there was probably a chamber under the Sphinx. I think Dr. DeBecky would rather use the word possibly, but in any event, certainly there was something worth investigating there, and I mm-hmm. think that we established pretty clearly that a case for an older Sphinx, which is what we set out to do, and it entertained a lot of people, and John won an Emmy and so forth. To make a long story short, I walked into Zahi's office in August, and I said, look, you know, I have an apartment here in Egypt and a horse, and I'd like to know whether there's something I can do to make this up to you. And he said, let's do another film. And I will be your Egyptian host and whatever. What would we do a film about? And we had a very affable lunch. And I suggested to him something I'd always wanted to do, which was a documentary about legends surrounding the Great Sphinx. I mean, there are legends of King Solomon. There are all kinds of wonderful legends. And Zahi said, yeah, fine, let's do that. And how can I help you? And I said, well, I'd like to bring a crew over and we'll film you talking about Legends of the Sphinx. So he said, yes, I'll do that. And I went back to New York and I raised $50,000 from two investors and went back to Egypt with a crew. And we filmed Dr. Hawaz in talking about pyramids and tunnels and all sorts of wonderful things. Mm-hmm. And at one point, he said, well, where, Boris, do you think this thing will be shown? And I said, I think it'll be a cable show. And he said, well, why not a network? And I said, because I think if you want to have a network show, you've got to have some extraordinary piece of news, something that will get their attention.
Sure.
And he said, what about if we open a tunnel that's never been opened before? And I said, where? And he said, under the Sphinx. And I said, that would do it.
That would do it.
Right. So Dr. Hawaz took us out to the rear of the Sphinx one day with our crew following along obediently. And he crawled down into a hole under the tail of the Sphinx, which we've since been in and done radar studies and found nothing, I might tell you. But there's a huge sort of an excavation inside the rump of the Sphinx, which has been all shored up like a mine shaft. And they've been prowling around in there. And Dr. Hawaz allowed himself to be filmed standing in the bottom of that hole.
Uh-huh.
And he said, it's a great quote. He wrote it. I wish I'd written it. He said, even Indiana Jones wouldn't dream to be here now. We're now inside the body of the Sphinx, and we don't know where this tunnel leads, but we're going to open it for the first time. So with that in hand, with that statement in hand and some lovely sort of images of the Sphinx and the pyramids, I came back to New York and set about selling a documentary.
So one of the networks. This time you were going to the networks.
And I went to the network. And one of the networks did, in fact, express some interest. And they said, look, if you're really going to open this thing, sure, we're interested. So at that point, I talked to Dr. Shore, who I knew had a great interest in this and who I'd talked to before I went the first time and told them what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Shore said, well, we'd like to get involved, and I think the next amount of money we needed was $100,000, and he said, well, I'll put up the $100,000, and we entered into a joint venture agreement, and the deal was that he was going to be in charge of all science, and I was going to do the filming.
And when was this agreement entered into?
In December of 1955.
December?
1995. Okay. Right. So we then went back to Egypt in March with a full crew for, I think, almost 5 weeks. And we filmed some beautiful tombs on the West Bank, and we filmed in Luxor, and then we came down to the Giza Plateau, and Dr. DeBecky joined us, and there was a lot of ground-penetrating radar and sonar exploration of the plateau.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shore had a 5-year permit from the Egyptian government, renewable each year, and that was what he was operating under, and I had a permit to film his work. And he was paying the expenses at that point. Every time we needed more money, I would say, shall I raise some money? And he would say, no, I'll put it up. And so he became de facto the financial sponsor of the project.
This is Mr. Shore.
Yes,
uh-huh.
Dr. Shore,
right.
And his foundation. In April and early May, Dr. DeBecky, with ground-penetrating radar, confirmed what he'd found in 1991 with his seismic work. He confirmed that there was, in fact, a chamber under the paws of the Sphinx, that it looked to be about 30 by 40 feet, and it looked to be about 35 feet below the surface. But, of course, we're dealing with shadows and disturbed earth. And
nevertheless, again, this is the X-ray, ground-penetrating
yes.
X-ray, that was confirming what the ultrasound had already done.
Exactly. He also, around the back of the Sphinx, discovered a tunnel about 2 meters wide that seemed to be about 15 feet below the surface, coming out of the tail of the Sphinx and heading in a westerly direction up under the causeway towards the Khafre or Chephren pyramid. Now, at that point, Dr. Shore requested permission to do some diamond drilling and drill a hole down into the under the paw, and that was refused. They said, oh no, you know, you can never drill under this, you might damage the Sphinx, etc., etc., and basically they agreed to take it under advisement, but Dr. Shore was running the permit end of things, you see, so I was just told, well, wait and we'll have it for the next trip.
Mm-hmm.
So we came back in November, and in November we brought Tom Danley with us, and took Tom Danley. That's when he did his resonance experiments up in the Great Pyramid, because I felt that the whole show shouldn't just hang on
whether or not you can drill underground.
That's right. If we get underground and there's a tablet that says made in Atlantis, well, eureka, nobody will believe it anyway, right? So I thought we needed some other corroboration besides just the records. And so Danley did his work, and we filmed all of that, and we got some wonderful footage. And also we found an interesting thing. I had been told, and I got to go back away, Art, here, in 1992, one of the plateau guards, for a princely sum of, I don't know, $20 or something, took me late one night down a well.
I know. Now we're getting into the area of the photographs that I've got on the website, correct?
Okay. Yes.
All right. What I'm going to want to do is, again, tell everybody the photographs we're about to discuss are on my website, if you wish to go see them, at www.artbell.com. And so with that in mind, we'll take the photographs one by one. So you paid somebody $20.
To take me down the well, take me down an iron ladder, a rusty iron ladder.
Where was this well?
Under the causeway, leading from the Sphinx to the Chephren Pyramid.
Uh-huh.
And it was about halfway up the causeway.
Okay.
But the story that I was told by an old Nubian guide was that the well had been dug in 1946, after the war, in a search for water. And that there were two little Nubian kids down in the well chipping away with hammer and chisel, which was how they dug in those days, when the bottom of the well collapsed, and they fell about 30 feet.
Uh-huh.
When the dust had settled and they lit their torches, they found that they were sitting, to their horror, on a sarcophagus.
On a sarcophagus?
Right. And there was a tunnel, they said, leading down towards the Sphinx. And that part of the story may have been exaggerated. And in that tunnel were other sarcophagi.
Uh-huh.
And they were terrified, and they ran up out of the well, and they said, we're not going back down there, and there's no water anyway, and the thing was abandoned. I have no idea if it's a true story or not.
It might have been myth.
But 20 years later, they built the Aswan Dam, and it raised the water level, the water table, on the Giza Plateau by some 25 feet.
Right.
Or maybe even 46 feet, depending on who you believe. And to make a long story short, lo and behold, there was water in the well. And the Egyptians put a motor down there and a pump and actually pumped water out of that well for 20 years.
20 years?
Well, for quite a while.
Using it as a water source?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
From 1965 or 6 on.
Not trying to pump it out, just using it as a water source.
Using it as a water source. Now, again, that's hearsay, but that's what I was told. So in 1992, when we went down in that well, at the bottom of the iron steps, which were pretty rickety, let me tell you, there was this cavern like that was, I would say, filled to within about 6 feet of the ceiling.
All right,
brackish water.
Yeah, let me back up. I've got the first photograph, which shows the pyramid in the background, at least a portion of it, somebody's red car, and 1, 2, 3, 4 gentlemen there.
That's our film crew.
That's your film crew.
That's right.
And it shows this immense, is that the well?
No.
I mean, it's an immense cavern of
What we did at the time, in order to basically conceal the location, because everything was all secret, you know, we were sworn to all this secrecy.
Sure.
We filmed these guys rappelling down that shaft, which actually led nowhere.
Okay.
The well is accessible by a fairly rickety and dangerous ladder. And the well is, I would say, 120 meters west and slightly south of that shaft.
All right. Hold it right there, and we'll pick up when we get back. All right. Now, the first photograph you'll see is of this film crew standing by this immense cavern, which you can readily see would be hidden by those normal tourists around the Great Pyramid. And the second picture you'll see is of somebody rappelling down the side of this immense cavern, which Boris has just told us leads absolutely nowhere. When we come back, we'll find out exactly where we're going next. This is Coast to Coast.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from September 22nd, 1997.
Got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman. I've got a black magic woman, got me so blind I can't see. That's she's a black magic woman. She's trying to make a devil out of me.